New Books in South Asian Studies. An empire more populous, more amazing, and more beneficent than that of Rome. These words from an India hand inspired a teenaged schoolboy to dedicate his life to the service of Britain's Indian Empire. This was in 1876. 75 years later, another Indian civilian would write about the Indian civil service being the head of Plato, a service minutely just, inflexibly upright. From George Curzon to Philip Mason, most colonial administrators had had classical educations, a process which ensured that the British Empire was always set aside the Roman Empire insofar as evaluating imperial greatness was concerned. It was not for the British to measure themselves against the empires of the European contemporaries. Mark Bradley has put together a series of essays, Classics and Imperialism in the British Empire, looking at links across various spheres of imperial life and thought. He will talk to us today about how classical reception influenced the formation of ideology and polity in imperial Britain, both at home and abroad.
Good morning, Mark.
Okay, hello.
Yes.
Hi, Dara.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the New Books Network.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be
invited. So could you just start off by telling us something about yourself and your research today before we go on to your very fascinating book, that's Classics and Imperialism in the British Empire. But how did you come up to the point where you wrote the book?
Right, okay. I'm Dr. Mark Bradley, and I am a lecturer in ancient history at the University of Nottingham in the UK. I finished my PhD in 2004, which was looking at the use and perception of colours in ancient Rome and comparing ancient approaches to colour to modern approaches to colour. So a very classical subject. I'm a classicist by training. I moved to Nottingham after my PhD and worked my PhD into a book which came out in 2009. And at the same time, I was developing interests in classical reception, the reception of ancient Greece and Rome in the modern world. And while I was in Cambridge, I teamed up with another PhD student called Emma Rice, who is a modern British imperial historian. And we decided to pool our interests and hold a conference on classics and imperialism during the British Empire. And that conference was held in Nottingham in 2005. And 5 years after the conference, the volume based on that conference came out, which is the book you're interviewing me about today. I think that's a pretty comprehensive account. I've since moved on. We'll talk about what I'm doing later. Yeah.
Great. So could you tell us something about the book itself?
Okay, the book itself is a collection of 10 essays by a combination of ancient historians and modern historians. So it really is interdisciplinary. It's finding ways of getting classicists and modern historians working together. Each of the essays provides a window onto exploring the relationship between the ancient world and the modern world in the context of British Empire. So it's looking at the influence of ancient Greece and Rome on the development of ideas during the British Empire. It's also looking at the impact of the British Empire on how we look back at the ancient world. So it's a two-way process that the book is examining. Okay, anything specific you want me to...
Could you just tell us a little bit about the essays that you have contributed to the volume, Symbolism of Empire and the Classical Text, and obviously the introduction. Could you just tell us something about the main theme?
Apart from the kind of overall concept of the volume, which is looking at this two-way relationship between classics and colonialism. My contributions are twofold. First is the introduction where I lay out the theory, the ideas, and I also have an extended examination of the British Museum as a case study for exploring this relationship. My main chapter in the volume is looking at a classical text, which is a biography by the historian Tacitus of his father-in-law. His father-in-law was called Agricola, and he was the governor of Roman Britain in the first century AD. And this biography is looking at basically Roman imperialism in Britain, so Britain on the receiving end of empire. And in fact, it's a very difficult text because Tacitus does not thoroughly endorse Roman imperialism. It doesn't say Roman Empire is a great thing and the territories should be glad that they've been conquered by Rome. It's actually a very complex and sometimes critical account of Roman imperial influences in Britain. So I knew this text a long, long time ago. It's a text that I studied at school, it's a text that I worked on at university. But I wondered how this very difficult interpretation of imperialism was received, interpreted, evaluated during the British Empire. And when I started doing my research, I found some very interesting things about how this text was drawn upon to reflect on British imperial activities in India and in other colonies. That's a contribution which looks at the influence of the classical text during the British Empire. Other contributions in the volume look at the influence of, say, classical sculpture during the British Empire. So one of many windows onto the subject.
So it's very interesting because you mentioned this thing about Tacitus being somewhat ambivalent about the Roman Empire. He didn't really approve of it on all levels. And that is actually something that comes out very strongly when you read the early accounts of the British in India. So you think this examination, this self-doubt, was it something that actually proceeded from the familiarity with the classics?
Yes, absolutely. What Tacitus was doing was perhaps a rather different exercise from what we might expect. I mean, Tacitus is an orator above everything else. He's an orator who becomes a historian. And as an orator in ancient Rome, what you had to do is to be able to take command of different sides of the argument. So you had to pretend to be somebody endorsing Roman imperialism, and you had to pretend to be somebody criticizing Roman imperialism. And as a good orator, he could command both sides of the debate. So, very interestingly, what he was doing with Roman imperialism in his text is actually quite similar to what the British started doing at the end of the 19th century in their own debates about empire. So criticisms of empire didn't often come from the colonies, they came from within Britain itself. So you have, you know, in the House of Parliament, debates about, you know, the British behaving badly, the British behaving well, the British spreading civilization, the British being dominating and bullying. And what's happening is, just like Tacitus in the first century AD, the British in the 19th century start playing the same game. Is they show their own responsibility as imperial colonizers by taking command of both sides of the debate. So the debate itself becomes, you know, is owned by the British in the same way that Tacitus owned the debate about Roman imperialism. So that was quite a complex idea, but it's one that started to make a lot of sense in various chapters in the volume, but particularly mine on the Agricola.
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense when you think about how it helps them process their ideas and think about, you know, the systems of administration. But what about the fact that when the colonized come across these arguments, you know, that from one of the empire builders that maybe empire is not such a good thing, would that not actually serve to, you know, kind of weaken the, you know, the united front, the colonial rules of the present?
Yes, I mean, you know a lot more about the sort of details of modern history of this this idea, but certainly a lot of the, you know, a lot of the kind of post-colonial debates that are very common now in modern scholarship were already sort of going on during the British Empire. And of course, yes, they weaken the overall concept of what the British are doing, and eventually, you know, it's part by the British Empire collapses. But at the same time, I think there is a sort of a sense of healthy debate going on, certainly within Britain, about the pros and cons of empire. And so long as the British are scrutinising empire properly and identifying weak areas, they can stamp those out. And this is, you know, again, I think this is what Tacitus was doing in the first century AD.
Well, there is just a very interesting text, I don't know whether you come across it. It's a 1954 book by Philip Mason, The Men Who Ruled India.
Okay.
Yeah, he makes a lot of references to Plato. He actually really, like, presents the British in India as the heirs of Plato, you know. And he talks about, like, this Platonic Empire, and that was, like, the main justification for the British being in India.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with the book. But it's an idea, it's an argument that I come across very often. I have a colleague in Reading called Firoz Basunia, who is a specialist on this aspect, and I mean he's published several things, articles and books, playing out this sort of argument. Certainly, yeah. Okay, so.
So could you tell us something about the different subsections that you've got in the book? Why did you include the books that you actually included?
Okay, well, pretty much all of the contributors were speakers at the conference. And we found actually the conference worked extraordinarily well in spite of the disparate subject matter. There was a lot of coherence, a lot of dialogue between the papers. What we have is we have a collection of 10 essays covering the full chronological range of the Second British Empire from the late 18th century through to the early mid 20th century. And they cover lots of different geographical territories as well. So we have, first of all, looking at the contents list again to remind myself. We have Kostas Vlasopoulos talking about 18th century uses of ancient history in scholarship about empire and about the importance of ancient empires for colonial policymakers towards the end of the 18th century. And then after that we move on to Rama Mantana, who is a modern imperial historian who works on India, looking at, well, one of the things she looks at is the relationship that was drawn in the late 18th and early 19th century between Latin and Greek and the language of ancient India. The linguistic relationship between the two languages was used as a way of establishing common ground between the British and the Indians in the early stages of the conquest of the colonization of India. The idea is that basically both the British, the West, and India both come from the same roots, the idea is the British parade themselves as being technologically and in terms of civilization more advanced, so their job in India then becomes to kind of raise the civilization of India to the same level. It's a civilizing mission. The idea is that the British themselves have, you know, in the past been conquered by the Romans, and now look how advanced they are. And the principle applies that if the British can do the same thing in India as the Romans did in Britain, then India will reach the same stage of civilization. So, specifically looking at India, Margaret Williamson in Chapter 3 looks at, takes the focus onto the West Indies, looking particularly at a British traveller who writes literature influenced by the classics in order to establish the British as being part of a sort of superior race. Then Debbie Challis is also looking at racial theory in the British Empire. She looks at Victorian racial theory, and she what she argues is that basically in the 19th century a lot of emphasis was placed on physical beauty and racial perfection among the ancient Greeks, and that's evident in all the sort of sculpture that you go and see in the British Museum. It's all very, very beautiful, very pure, you know, very strong physiques, that sort of thing. There was a chap called Robert Knox in the 1840s and 1850s who argued that the ancient Greeks were actually more like the Saxons in Britain than they were like modern Greeks, and therefore the classical past and classical antiquities rightly belong to the British. The Elgin marbles belong in Britain, not in modern Greece, because the modern Greeks don't really own them. So that was a chapter I particularly enjoyed in the volume. So from then there's my chapter on Agricola and its use, its evaluation during the British Empire. There's a chapter by David Fern on the smuggling out of Egypt in the late 19th century of a papyrus by Bacchylides, a poet called Bacchylides, and the way in which he smuggled it out surreptitiously from Egypt in order to take it to the British Museum. So it's about British ownership of a classical text. And then there are two chapters about theme of decline in the British Empire, the way in which British imperial thinkers looks to the ancient world to think about decline. So, for example, Emma Rice connects a disease theory which was developed to explain a crisis in ancient Greece in the 4th century BC, connects that theory to fears about the dangers posed by tropical territories to Western health during the British Empire. So another different window. And the final two chapters do something quite different. Final two chapters look at efforts to wrest ownership of the classical past from the dominating grasp of the British. So first, Abhishek Kaikar looks at an Indian Muslim poet at the end of the 19th century who exploited classical literature in his own work. So he played the British at their own game. He said, actually, you know, the colonized themselves can use the classical heritage for their own benefit to develop their own literature, their own cultural identity. So that was a way of taking the emphasis away from the metropolis onto the colonies themselves. Secondly, the final chapter in the volume is Margaret Malamud, who looks at America at the turn of the 20th century, where classical motifs in urban architecture, in theatre, in spectacle, start to advertise America as the new manifestation of imperial folk in the modern age, not Britain. So, you know, the volume comes full circle. There's quite a number of different windows onto this relationship between classics and colonialism. So I'm quite happy with how the volume shaped out and the general coverage that it has. It's not, of course, a comprehensive history of the relationship between classics and colonialism, but it does, you know, it covers a lot of ground, and I'm happy with the way it's come out.
Yeah, it's quite linear. If you look at it, there's a flow down there. It's chronological. I mean, you start off with the ancient world and then actually move on, you know, to something that's post-colonial, and or some might argue neo-colonial. So that's very interesting, I mean, in terms of structure. But that's very interesting in terms of structure. But the one thing is, why have you chosen to begin the book with an examination of the British Museum and its role in forging links between the classical world and the empire?
Yes. We all know about the Elgin Marbles and the debate about whether the Elgin Marbles belong in Britain or in Greece, and that's still ongoing. It's a very complex debate, and I can't see British Museum giving the marbles back in a hurry, because in fact that's just the tip of the iceberg. Not only in the British Museum, but in museums all around the world, there are hundreds and hundreds of artifacts that actually belong somewhere else, that were taken away from their place of origin as a result of the exercise of power and colonialism in various territories. So I looked at the broader picture of this within the British Museum and the development of British Museum's relationship with the classical world, and how this relationship changed as the British Empire developed. So it's a very two-way relationship. British Museum, founded in 1759, at first it was celebrated for its natural history, its collections of stuffed animals and insects from all around the world. And that, of course, is itself a result of Britain's imperial expansion. It has the power, the resources, the reach to get animals and plants and insects and all sorts of things from the far reaches of the empire. But by the end of the 18th century, early 19th century, classical antiquities start to take over as the main focus of the British Museum. It becomes very important for Britain to say, we are the inheritors of the ancient Greeks and Romans. We are the new Rome, the new Greece. We have the technological superiority, the cultural superiority, and we have a grasp of morality and philosophy comparable to that of the ancient Greeks. So it becomes very important for the British Empire to start amassing classical antiquities from Greece and Italy. And the Elgin Marbles is just one of many, many examples. In fact, Parliament in the mid-19th century releases funds specifically for the acquisition of artifacts from Italy and Greece. So you have travellers, colonial officers going over to the Greek world, Roman world, and buying things with their quite considerable financial resources. And those financial resources are supplied by empire. Imperial income into Britain starts to be used to purchase antiquities for the British Museum. So that's one thing, and that goes on and on and on. It stops in the 20th century for obvious reasons. It stops when British imperialism starts to crumble. But the other interesting pattern is the structure of departments within the British Museum. So the Department of Antiquities was founded, I think, in 1807, that combined Greek and Roman antiquities. It had Romana British antiquities, and it had some antiquities from further afield, from India, from across the Atlantic, and so on and so forth. I think it was 1861, the British Museum decided to split this collection into two departments: the Department of Greek and Roman Antiquities, Department of Classical Antiquities, and the Department of Oriental Antiquities. So it becomes an east-west split in these departments, and so visitors to the museum can compare the antiquities of Greece and Rome, which of course are much prettier and much nicer than all of these kind of weird things from India and Africa and so on. So it becomes this real east-west divide. And then a little bit later, because Oriental antiquities included finds from Roman Britain, they weren't part of classical antiquities, they were part of Oriental antiquities, they decide to create a separate department of Romano British antiquities. So you get kind of three different departments where you can compare the relationship between Roman Britain, Greece and Rome, and the imperial peripheries. So, I mean, that, those are a couple of examples of interesting findings from that, that research. So the British Museum is a really, really good case study for thinking about what's going on and how it changes over time.
So was there any attempt made to export this classical culture to the museums or exhibition houses in the colonies?
This is a subject that, as I mentioned earlier, Thérèse Vasunia has worked on. Certainly, I mean, there's certainly a lot of emphasis on neoclassical architecture in British India. There's some very good work that's been done on that. So the idea that the British presence in India starts to look very classical. The other aspect of this is that in the 19th century, the British Museum starts to make casts, make copies of its statues, its sculpture, and then to sell those to other collections, both in Britain and further afield. I don't know of any specific examples of casts being sent over to the colonies, but there may well be. But again, this is British Museum saying we own these classical antiquities and we can sell fake copies of them around the world. So it's a way of advertising that sort of ownership, that ownership of classical past.
So basically, when this whole thing about classical culture, when it was exported to the colonies, what was the idea? Was the idea that the colonized would look at classical culture and think that this was something they were to aspire to? Or were they supposed to look at the British as their ideal, you know, the modern British?
I think that's certainly an idea that's toyed with by various contributions in my volume. I mean, certainly Rama Mantana's work on the philology of ancient India and its relationship to Greek and Latin. The idea is that colonies start absorbing and learning Greek and Roman culture, they can eventually get to the same stage of education and civilization as the British. And the idea is then, you know, there were theorists, as you will know, theorists who are arguing that when India reaches that level of civilization, the British have achieved their job and they can leave. So there is this idea of progress and classics. The classical world plays an important part in achieving and reaching this progress. So that's certainly an idea, yeah.
Hegemony and Cornucopia, to illustrate this. Could you elaborate on that theme?
Okay, so Hegemony and Cornucopia. We were going to call the volume Hegemony and Cornucopia in the British Empire, but that's quite an awkward title. I don't think many people would understand that was about. It wouldn't be a very attractive title. So we were told to change it. But nonetheless, these were two themes that guided the original conference and that quite a few of the contributions in the volume speak to. Two themes. I mean, hegemony is a complex concept which has had a lot of recent scholarship devoted to it. But the kind of subtle command of cultural superiority exercised by colonial powers over the subjects, and it's kind of very related to the work of Edward Said on discourses of power, on architecture and literature and visual culture and theatre and drama and all that sort of stuff, and the way in which subtly all of those discourses exercise power over other people. So hegemony is one of the because so many of the chapters in my volume are about discourses, hegemony is a very useful theme to focus on. Cornucopia is another important theme, which is cornucopia is the horn of plenty, and it's a symbol from the ancient world, which figures used to, like emperors, used to carry around these horns filled with wheat and grapes and things that are showing prosperity and material resources. And this symbol becomes important, again, in the British Empire, the idea that British are, have the resources to help the world, to spread goods around the world. These two themes are very important. You can see them playing out in the British Museum. So the idea of the British Museum has all of these classical antiquities and antiquities from further afield, it has. It amasses resources in one space in the metropolis. This is cornucopia in practice. But also by doing this, it exercises a form of hegemony over the rest of the world. Quite complex concepts. But they do feature in many of the chapters throughout the volume.
It's on page 125, in fact, you have an argument, where Tacitus talks about the Britons being gradually led astray by the allurements of vice, all that is called civilization when it was in fact only a feature of their enslavement. So that, I think, could you link it to the concept of cornucopia and the fact that, the British Empire, or in fact all the other European empires at the time, started out as, very commercial entities. So the basis for colonialism, or in fact the interaction between the colonialists and the natives, was based around the acquisition of material goods.
Yes, I mean, this is, obviously the origins of the British activities in India are something I don't know a great deal about, but obviously the economic focus of the original dealing in India is very important. The Roman Empire is driven by, I think, rather different concerns, and it's about military conquest and expansion of Rome is a way of achieving glory within Roman society. So the idea that to become a proper Roman, you have to kill a lot of barbarians and you have to take over their territories. And this is, this is the kind of logic behind which the Roman Empire expands. So that's a rather different focus from the British, the origins of the British Empire. But certainly this cynical comment by Tacitus that all of the British, when they were taken over by the Romans, the British thought, ooh, look at all these baths, look at all these feasts, look at all these aqueducts, aren't they brilliant? Aren't the Romans doing us a favour by civilising us? Okay, so that's Romanization, and that's, civilisation, that's the positive side of empire. But Tacitus says they were all being duped. In fact, the Romans were turning them into slaves. Okay, that's a very famous comment by Tacitus. In the Agricola, the idea is that empire looks good, but actually it's just a form of enslavement. And the way that single passage in Tacitus was used and quoted by people during the British Empire is very interesting. Sometimes people attacking the British Empire would quote that and say, this is what the British are doing in India and elsewhere. It's essentially a form of enslavement. Other people said, well, actually the British have learned from the ancient world and they're not going to make the same mistakes. So the British are spreading Christianity and really good things that the Romans never thought of around their empire. So Tacitus said that about the Romans. You can't say that about the British. So, it was used in very interesting ways.
Yeah,
so I probably answered your question specifically.
Because it's an argument that really comes up when you talk about railways, specifically railways, because the British introduced railways to India, and that was supposed to be really good. The propaganda that you get in the modern history textbook is that, railways united the country, gave Indians a sense of being Indian, or well, created an Indian identity, and then you have this little subtext always, that the British never really intended to build a railway for the benefit of the Indians. It was only so that, they could get their armies to any point in time.
I think this is the interesting thing about, both in the ancient world and in modern imperial history, there's no single way of interpreting any imperial activity. There are two very different ways of responding to imperial activity. One very positive interpretation, one very critical and negative interpretation, and both of these seem to exist side by side. So I was interested in thinking about how classical texts were used to explore these two sides of the debate. Richard Hingley has done a lot of very good work on the uses made of Imperial Rome by British policymakers and thinkers, particularly in terms of, you know, learning from past mistakes in order to improve the way the British are dishing out their kind of imperial activities.
Okay. So, as a classicist, if I ask you a populist question, how would you compare the British Empire and the Roman Empire?
British Empire, Roman Empire. Well, the British did more of it. The Roman Empire was, for a long time, the very, you know, the largest imperial territory that anybody had ever known about. The British made a big point of outdoing the Romans in that respect. Okay, so that's one aspect. I mean, the other aspect is, you know, the advantage the British had in their imperial activities was that they could claim to be spreading the true religion. And, you know, so, I mean, you get this played out in some colonial context. The Romans didn't claim to set out to impose their gods on their subjects. In fact, what they often did was they encountered a new community who worshipped a new god, and the Romans actually stole that god for themselves and added it to their pantheon of gods. So that was a different, the use of religion was quite a different process. The British claimed to be sort of doing one better than the Romans. There's a lot of comparable emphasis on the acquisition of resources, the improvement of the wealth of Rome and Britain during their respective empires. So a lot of comparative stuff there. And these are very general comments, and there are others better informed than myself to supply details on these. Okay, I mean, yeah, I could go on, but you get the idea.
Yeah, and in fact, on page 290, you mentioned that the early historians of classical scholarship did not discuss the relationship between classics and modern empire. So why do you think it took so long for people to start making these connections and these comparisons?
Yeah, so this is actually Firoz Basunia who wrote the final section for you. Why did it take so long? Well, I think it starts to happen when British imperial activities are stepped up, and when scrutiny starts to be applied to British imperial activities. So really, this is why my volume focuses on the Second British Empire. So this is when classical scholarship starts to compare ancient and modern empires, starts to think about the pros and cons of empire. So it's a long time since I looked at this section. No, I think that seems to be the answer that I go with that. Okay.
And one more thing, was it only the British who actually tried to appropriate the Greco-Roman world for their own purposes, or was it like other colonial powers as well, like the French, for instance? What relationship did they have with the classical world?
Yeah, no, this is one area where my volume falls down a bit, in that it focuses solely on the British and what's going on in Britain and how some of those ideas are spread around to the colonies. I'm not an expert in this, but the French and the Germans were playing the same game, and they were competing with British for ownership of classical past. So the British Museum was very impressive and had lots of classical antiquities, but so did the Louvre, and so did the Glyptothek in Munich, and they were all competing to gather as much of classical antiquity as possible, to take ownership, to be the inheritors of classical past. In fact, because the British Empire was so much larger than anywhere else, the British ended up having more resources, more reach, more money to do this. So the British Museum had, you know, probably a much more impressive collection of antiquities than the French and the Germans had. But of course, this shifted over time. Absolutely. So on the one hand, you know, different powers around Europe were playing the same game and you know, exercising the same authority over their own subjects. As Margaret Malamud shows in the final chapter here, and as we know about the influences of Greece and Rome on modern American culture, America started from the end of the 19th century to take command of the classical past in rather different ways. They do have collections of classical antiquities, but a huge emphasis on neoclassical architecture, on making their cities, some of which were very new, seem like models of ancient Rome, in order to demonstrate their own grandeur, their own superiority. Margaret Malamud talks a lot about popular culture in America and how sort of drama and literature was influenced by Greece and Rome. So, and that's been ongoing. So in as much as we can argue that America has an empire these days, that empire is still very much informed by a lot of Greek and Roman ideas.
And please go on.
Sorry?
Please continue about the relationship between America and, you know, the empire being formed
here. Oh, I would, but I... in my department in Nottingham, there's a PhD student who's just started, who is looking at the influence of Thucydides, who's an ancient Greek historian who writes about Greek empire. So Thucydides' ideas about empire are being used in modern republican politics in America. Now, I'm not supervising that, and I don't know much about the details, but certainly there's an interesting overlap there. So, you know, this is still going on.
Yeah.
Classics is not a dead subject. It is very much, you know, informing developments that are going on in the 21st century, as well as my volume shows, developments that happened in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries.
So how do you think decolonization actually affected the study of classics, or at least in terms of looking at its links with the British Empire?
Within classics, when you talk about the relationship of the classical world to the modern world, there are two models. And one model we call the classical tradition, and it imagines ancient Greece and Rome pushing their way forward through time and influencing the modern world in a very kind of, you know, autonomous steamroller effect. So, you know, it's a push model. The ancient world is really powerful and it pushes its way forward into the modern world. Another model is classical reception, where you see modern people grabbing the ancient world and pulling it forward for their own purposes. Oh, we can use the Roman Empire to help us think about British Empire, so it's a pull model. My approach is committed to a bit of both, so the idea of a push and pull effect. And one way this plays out, as you've alluded to, is not only is the ancient world influencing modern ideas, but modern ideas, modern developments in empire, modern developments in politics, modern ideas about race are also affecting the way that we study ancient Greece and Rome. So if you look at the important subjects in classics in the 20th century, one of them has indeed been empire. So there are lots and lots and lots of books produced about the Athenian Empire, the Roman Empire, during the heyday of British Empire. From the 1960s, there are lots of studies of women and female behaviour in Greece and Rome because feminism, because female roles in modern society become so much more important as talking points. So, you know, by all means, Greek and Roman approaches to women are being used to help us think about modern gender issues, but at the same time, modern gender issues are shaping the way we look at ancient Greece and Rome. So those are two examples of that influence playing out.
So, Mark, where do you see your own research fitting into this?
How do I see my own research fitting into this? Well, I mean, this, as I said at the beginning, this is a little bit of a sideline for me. I teach classical reception. I teach the influence of the ancient world on modern film and theatre and novels and literature and architecture and that sort of thing. I teach it to my undergraduates. And so I have interest in this, but my own research is principally looking into aspects of Roman culture. So I don't know if I'll return to this emphasis on classics in the modern world in my research. I'm doing a very different sort of area of research at the moment. I mean, do you want me to say a little bit about my current research?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. So, I mean, for a long time, I've been interested in Roman approaches to dirt and pollution and to things being unclean. And I did my master's thesis back in 1999 looking at how Romans clean their clothes. And the interesting thing was that Romans, this hyper-civilized race in the ancient world, used human urine almost always to clean their clothes.
Oh, that's nasty.
It's a powerful grease-dissolving detergent. So it actually does work. And in fact, lots of ancient societies have used urine to get stains out of their clothes, to, you know, remove oil and grease and that sort of thing. But my interest was sparked by the idea of how did the Romans get around the problem of using human waste clean themselves? And so that got me thinking more broadly about the role of cleanliness and pollution in ancient societies, and that's what my current project is. So I've just finished editing a volume for Cambridge University Press looking at the city of Rome in ancient, medieval and modern times and how issues of cleanliness and purity and pollution have informed the development of the history of the city of Rome. So that's a collection of essays by different people, modern experts and ancient experts, looking at this theme. And I'm writing a book, which is just my book, on foul bodies in ancient Rome. So bodies in ancient Roman society that were perceived to be disgusting or didn't fit expectations of what a body should look like. So I'm looking at really fat bodies in ancient Rome, really thin bodies, you know, giants and dwarfs, smelly bodies, bodies that are used for unclean or disgusting purposes, that sort of thing, in order to help me understand the Roman value system. So you can see this is the sort of thing that I'm working on now. So I am interested again in comparing modern and ancient approaches to dirt and pollution. In fact, we would never think about washing our clothes in urine, but actually until 1935, fulleries in England used human urine to prepare clothing. There are other examples of urine and human waste being used in industrial processes that, you know, we find slightly uneasy. I mean, it's the same sort of thing as, you know, some people don't like the idea of using manure to grow their vegetables. Other people don't like the idea of using artificial fertilizers to grow their vegetables. It's a very, you know, complex approach to what is appropriate and what is inappropriate in modern societies. This is a very important theme in anthropology. There's an important anthropologist called Mary Douglas who wrote a book called Purity and Danger. I don't know if you've read that or come across that. Basically, she argued that dirt in any society is matter out of place, and when something is out of place, it changes from culture to culture.
Yeah, that is subjective. Yes.
Yeah. So you know, for us, urine on clothes is matter out of place, but it's not matter out of place for the Romans because urine actually cleans clothes. You see what I mean? You know, for some of us, manure on our vegetable patches is matter out of place for some of us, biological conditioners in our washing machines. It's a matter out of place. So I am interested in comparing modern and ancient systems, and I think every classicist today needs to be acutely aware of the relationship between the ancient world and the modern world. You know, we're always facing this struggle of justifying why we study societies that died out 2,000 years ago. And I hope, you know, my book on the British Empire is one example, one small example of why it's so important to know what's going on in the ancient world and how it's affected the development of modern ideas. And, you know, comparing approaches to dirt in ancient Rome to approaches to dirt in modern Rome, and the differences and similarities between the two, is actually very enlightening for thinking about our own approach to life and identity and culture and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, in terms of similarities, I mean, a lot of very ultra-orthodox modern Indians, they drink cow urine or human urine for therapeutic purposes. And that is, I don't get it, but yeah, like you could make a comparison.
Yeah, I remember, well, I mean, back in the early 90s, I remember watching television and there was presenter Des O'Connor, and he was interviewing an actress, a famous actress whose name I can't remember now, but she came on and she said, as part of the interview, she said, "Oh, I drink a glass of my own urine every night before I go to bed." And, you know, the idea is it sort of purges the body. There's something that's dirty, purges the body. And I think it does have some proven positive medical effects. But then Des O'Connor, I think it was Des O'Connor, it might be Terry Wogan, I can't quite remember, said, "Oh, do you wash your hands afterwards? I suppose there's no point really, is there?" Which is quite funny, you know, playing around with the tensions of what is appropriate and inappropriate in, you know, in our engagement with waste. So, that got me thinking.
Yeah, so thanks very much. I mean, that was an amazing insight. I mean, about what is acceptable across time and space, you know, and obviously a book goes some way towards bridging the gap between, well, the ancient and the modern, you know, especially in terms of empires and administrative systems. So it was a pleasure to have you on the New Books Network.
Thank you very much.
And I'm only sorry you are not continuing your research on the empire.
Thank you very much.
But thanks again, and I'm sure this will be delightful for our listeners. Goodbye.
No problem. Okay, I'll speak to you soon.
So, Fox, a lovely interview about a very obvious, very assiduously nurtured, but rarely articulated series of linkages, the classical world and the British Empire. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Goodbye.